Welcome back to Ever Ancient, Ever New, the podcast in which we search for the hidden gems and the forgotten treasures of the church. I'm joined by a special guest today, Jim Schrader.
Jim Schrader, yes.
And from Evansville, Illinois, or Indiana?
Indiana. Yes, right, okay. Southwestern corner of Indiana right
there. Yeah, yeah, good. So he's in town to do a talk at the parish, and I said, hey, this is a great opportunity to just get a little wisdom here on the podcast. It might be something a little different from the talk tonight and for people who aren't able to be there. So.
Appreciate the invite.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, this is great. Great to have you. So we've already been talking for an hour. We probably should have recorded all of that conversation as well.
Our car conversation.
Yes,
absolutely.
Let me start off with this, because probably you're a pediatric psychologist, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And that's a big title. And probably people think that you're a little bit crazy.
I mean, psychologists kind of get that rap sometimes, right? Yes. Well, they think you're analyzing you. That's the question I was getting.
Right.
Are you analyzing me right now? Yes.
But,
and I'm like, I got too many other things going on.
Right. So. Not only that, but I mean, you're Catholic, which is kind of crazy
right.
in this day and age.
Right.
And as a psychologist, I mean, that's crazy.
Right.
And then you have 8 kids.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Right.
That's crazy.
That, yes.
And then you do ultra marathons and triathlons. That's crazy.
I mean, we're piling it on.
Is there anything else we can throw on to get our listeners to stop listening? Because this guy is absolutely nuts.
I bike to work most days
for
the last 15 years. So that's probably on top of that
list.
And
you're anti cell phone.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. I want to be clear to your listeners here. I'm not anti cell phone, but I will say this. I have not had a cell phone really in my life. I did bring one with me today. When I travel, we kind of have a house cell phone.
Yeah.
But I have made the intentional decision all the way back. If you go all the way back to college, my wife and I would talk on a Lynn cell phone. But from that point forward, we got married and everything else. And I thank you, Amy, for being so supportive. But I've never had a cell phone from that point.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I like to tell kids today when, you know, they're like, well, my parents won't let me have a cell phone and blah, blah, blah. And there's this one family that I know, and they got 10 kids, and they're, you know, like, they're serious about their parenting. And they're like, no, we're not doing cell mm-hmm. phones.
Right.
Like, once you start driving, we'll talk about, you know, what type of phone you're getting, but it's not going to be a smartphone. And this kid's in middle school, and he's like, he comes up to us like, did you know that only 13% of middle schoolers don't have a cell phone? That puts me in the minority. But you could tell that he was a little bit proud of that also, you know?
Well, and to add to it, not only do I not have a cell phone, but we made the intentional choice, and we can talk about this more, but our oldest, who are twins, that are seniors this year, just got their first cell phone for Christmas.
Mm.
So we are the family. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of things to kind of come with this, but we made that intentional decision that they didn't have one through high school or much of high school. And, you know, it carries with it challenges, but it's actually been really nice. There's been a lot of great things that have come out of it. And as a psychologist, I mean, there's a lot of science behind the decisions there, but.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know. And I like to tell those kids, I say, well, I didn't have a cell phone until after I was out of college.
I mean, 100% of our graduating class didn't have a cell phone until,
well, they didn't have them back then. I'm like, that is not the point. I survived.
Right.
That's right. You know, my only complaint against not giving kids cell phones when they're young is that I have a close family that, you know, I watch them grow up and, you know, close friends with them, and now they're all adults. And so they'll, you know, I mean, their life in a different way, and it's just really neat. And they are terrible at texting.
Oh, no.
They just don't respond to text because they didn't have those years and years, those formative years.
Right.
Middle school is formative years. If you're not texting in middle school, you're probably going to be a bad texter the rest of your life. That's my theory.
I probably would be a bad texter. I probably would fall in that category. That's right. If you don't feel the pressure to have to text immediately when you're younger, right? You're probably not going to feel the pressure when you get older.
Yeah.
So. That's a side effect.
You haven't been conditioned by the dopamine hit the buzz in your pocket and like, ooh, I gotta respond to that right away so I can get another hit.
The FOMO has not taken over, right?
Yeah.
The fear of missing out on the text. So that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, good. Now, there was a priest I knew, and he was the vice rector of the seminary, and he was going to go. I'm like, he's going to go, no cell phone. And he did it for about 2 weeks mm-hmm. until the rector was like, I can never get a hold of you. You need to have cell phone.
You know, it's funny you mentioned this, though. I give a presentation every year to 8th graders about just general health, and we talk about a lot of different areas. And I do open up the idea that I haven't had a cell phone. And you should see the look on their faces when I say that. I mean, I've had questions over the year like, you know, almost like a look of shock. And I'll get these like kids firing up their hands. And some of the questions will go something like this, like, how do you get your kids to soccer practice? To which I say, I drive them to soccer practice. How do people get a hold of you? I'm like, well, I have a phone next to me on my desk. We have a, you know, general office phone. We've got phones at home. But, you know, they can't conceive of a world without it. And it has drawn some really funny questions over the years from these eighth graders who just, like, it blows their mind, right?
Right.
It seems impossible to live, even though, of course, you know, 20 years ago, we all lived without it, but it seems impossible.
Yeah. No, it's good. What are some of the, you know, like, we, many of us have seen the social dilemma. Mm-hmm. You know, if you haven't, I think it's really well it's worth well seeing.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, I remember seeing, I remember reading something in the, I think it was the Wall Street or New York Post or something, a number of years back, maybe 8 years, you know. So, but I remember, I mean, some of the studies that just jumped out to me were one of them was this. They did a test to see who did better on a test, an exam.
Yeah.
And if the phone was on your desk, which is where most kids' phones tend to be if they're allowed to have them in the classroom and that sort of thing. They did worse than if they were in their pocket, who did worse than if they were out in their locker.
Yep.
Which is fascinating. They weren't looking at them. They were all asked, was your phone a distraction to you? No, wasn't right. A distraction.
Right.
And they did worse the closer it was to their sphere of reference and their
And that was initially done at Rutgers and has since been replicated.
Okay, yeah.
And you're right, proximity, you know, as we get into so many different areas about this, it's interesting that proximity really does relate to how well like achievement's going to occur with relation to that phone. And so there's something about, I think this is one thing we have to consider as parents is that we probably don't put enough weight into the unconscious world. Like we often say, well, if I tell my kids to do this, or I teach my kids to not do this, then I think that that's going to work. And I'm not, of course, you know, as parents and as a father of eight, you know, we have to really teach our kids continuously. But what I would say from a psychology standpoint, from a research standpoint, is we're probably a little bit, I hate to use the word prideful, but prideful that our conscious actions can overwhelm the unconscious reality.
Mm.
And to your point about proximity, what the study kind of, you know, unveiled for everyone and has since unveiled in other studies is that just the unconscious reality of my phone being there is taking my attention and everything, you know, I always say as a psychologist, everything begins and ends with attention, right? So if your focus, wherever it is, it's going to, you know, it's going to basically impact things like memory and learning and all of that, right? So if my attention is this phone right here, and it's close enough that I'm thinking about what's coming into it, well, the seed of the unconscious is that I am dividing my attention, right?
And right,
so ultimately that what they found in that Rutgers study and others have found is that, like you said, over the course of a semester, the achievement went down and it's by the factor of just location in essence. There.
Wow.
So it's a pretty powerful, powerful example. You know, another powerful example to think about attention is that they, JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, published a study years ago. And what they did was they followed a group, large group of freshmen in high school. And so they followed them out for a couple of years. And they looked at lots of different variables, lots of things that could impact, like, and they were looking at attention specifically, right? But one of the variables they looked at was just the degree of usage of, you know, digital usage, online, you know, access and things like that. And the freshmen they looked at had no identified ADHD or any concerns. 2 years later, the group that had the high to moderate usage significantly differed in their attention, overall attention, and not just attention to, like, you know, screens or anything else, but overall. And even the more severe group really started to develop what looked like ADHD symptoms, even though they didn't have anything at all there. So, so I think as parents, we have to kind of be a little humble about the fact that way God designed our minds is that unconscious world plays a lot into what we do, right?
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking about this, you know, it's like, okay, you're doing this experimental parenting of not giving your kids cell phones.
Right.
Like, okay, well, you know, we'll see how they turn out. It's a great experiment, but we're living in the great experiment. Like we've not done tests on, like, well, you know, what's the long, because we're at the first generation of children right now, people who are graduating high school right now, cell phones have been in their life, their entire life.
Right.
It was this interesting point in my priesthood where I'm doing marriage prep, and I always, there's a part where I have to ask, like, hey, just write down your mom's phone number because we have to ask, you know, these mm-hmm. questions. And like, there's this point where people still remember their mom's phone, their phone numbers, because they didn't get a cell phone until after they were old enough that they'd already memorized phone numbers.
Right.
And then there's right. people like, so if you're older, like me, like all the phone numbers I had memorized, I have my 665-4924. That was my childhood yep. phone number.
4-4-7-1-7-0. Right?
Yes, I haven't lived yes. there in 30 years, yeah. you know? Yes. I remember that. Yeah. I don't know my mom's phone number, you know, right. because it's right. in the cell phone. I don't need to remember it. But like we're, this is an experiment. Like we're in the great experiment right now, 100%. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. And we see,
and we're concerned about where yeah. it's been going. You're right. We have declared this the last 15 years as one of the biggest social experiments that has ever really existed. Yeah. And if you think about the numbers, in 99, only 1 in 3 people had a cell phone, right? 2007 is when the iPhone was introduced, and it took a few years to migrate downward as far as age. And so in essence, really the last 15 years are this massive, massive social experiment, especially with our youth in that way too. So, and we're, you know, there's just a lot of areas we're starting to see come out of it.
It's fascinating, you know, I mean, technology in general, mm-hmm. but, I was taking a course, and it was kind of a historical survey. And the professor said at one time, we are more, or no, he's, how do you say it? Like somebody in the 1901 had more in common with somebody in, 1501 right. than right. they do in somebody in 2001.
You That's know? A really, I mean, striking thought. Think about it. Yeah. All the things, even in the last 20 years, how the rest of the world previously had no idea, right? If you had told C.S. Lewis back in the day, yeah. the internet's going to exist and all of this is going to come to be. And as you're reflecting on the world, that's going to reshape things. You know, I mean, most of those people would have thought that seems impossible, but that's a great point. It's like this tiny segment of history. And of course the risk is to think that life couldn't have existed outside that bubble, right?
But
like
right.
this tiny segment of history is so different from this massive segment that has existed before, largely related to the communication revolution, obviously the ability to travel like we do. You know, I mean, we sit here in Minneapolis having, you know, been able to do things that even 100 years ago people thought would have been possible, right? Yeah. So,
I think that's the danger, you know. So like, okay, cell phones, yeah, I mean, it's technology, it's helpful, it can be used well, it's a tool, like just like the car, just like, I mean, and we don't want to get into like the whole, I mean, there's a quote from like I forget who is it, like Socrates or Plato or something, like, oh, you know, books, you know, it's a bad thing because we're not going to remember things anymore, you know. And it's like, okay, so let's right. we don't want to be like down on technology. But I think the danger in our age in particular is that we think that we're better human beings because we have technology. We're progressing to a point where we're superior, and we think right. back and like, well, those people, they didn't even have cars, so they don't. It's like, well, no, they lived a different life, but we're not better because we have technology.
That's right.
And there's yeah. kind of this myth that we can just keep progressing technologically into, you know, like into gods.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't say it like that, but that's what all of the Avenger movies are about.
And I think the other danger that's inherent in that is that we call the danger of dependence and the danger of distraction, right? So if you think about those two dangers, right, is as we think we are progressing because we have technology, the risk, and again, we're seeing this playing out more from a scientific standpoint, is we're becoming increasingly distracted. In fact, they've done studies looking at the attention span of human beings in the last 15 years, and it's really declining significantly. And we're becoming so dependent that we can't imagine, again, how life could have existed outside of this area, right? So like you said, any tool, any device, potentially has good uses. But I think one of my worries as a psychologist and as a father and everything else is just that we are becoming more and more distracted and dependent in ways that we kind of, here's something I want to throw out. I think we're kind of struggling with the questions that we're asking that are most important. So here's one thing I run into a lot. You know, if people ask me, is the current like climate of how we're kind of immersing ourselves, is it more convenient? Is it more accessible? Is it, you know, provide more experiential opportunities? I can't ever say it doesn't, right? I mean, of course, this is so more convenient or experiential or accessible than it's ever been. But And that's often seen as progress, right? Like that's the mode of progress.
Right.
But if we ask people today, in the current climate that we're talking about right here, are we healthier? And by healthier, I mean physically healthier, psychologically healthier, socially healthier, and spiritually healthier with how this is being utilized. Well, having again spoke widely and kind of really been in the research for about 15 years, we really have a hard time saying that yes.
Right. Yeah.
So where are the questions coming from and where are we kind of prioritizing?
I think the other thing we can say is like, okay, we've been progressing. And I would say, what are we progressing towards?
It's a great question. What's our goal here?
What's our goal?
To be the most convenient society in history, or would we say that's not necessarily the goal we want to go after? You know, then I think that's the real question of today. And I run up against that a lot. I think that it's hard because when something is more convenient or more accessible, we as human beings in some ways are wired to kind of seek that out. Like, ooh, it seems nice. Even if like, you know, I a lot of my friends who give me a hard time about not having a cell phone will acknowledge too that—
Wait, you have friends
I have one friend who also doesn't have a cell phone. Trent, if you're out there, you know, we love to joke about those ones, right? So I actually have friends without having a cell phone. At least they tell me they're my friend. You know, we'll go with that, right?
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is that while the access is nice, I think many of them would acknowledge like, oh, but I don't like the fact that I feel like I'm chronically distracted by this device. And what do we do with that?
So every year I go on a silent retreat. Mm-hmm. You know, priests are required to do a retreat. It doesn't necessarily have to be a silent retreat. I love silent retreats. I remember early on in my priesthood going to retreats with big groups of priests and them sharing, we're sharing graces at the end. When several guys like, man, it took me like 3 days before I turned off my phone. And I'm like, what? Like that for me is like, no, turn this thing off. Like
right.
Throw it.
Toss it out. Right. Yeah. Go silent.
So this year I went on a retreat in Arizona and it was just a hermitage. So I had a little hut all to myself in the canyon. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any schedule. There's nobody else there. I had the hut. I had the chapel. I had my prayer books. I brought a couple other things and I was like, well, maybe I'll read this book and maybe I'll work on this writing project that I've been wanting to work on. I found the Lord just inviting me into a real simplicity of silence, of slowing down, and of not multitasking. Mm-hmm. And so whereas my normal morning, I'll wake up and I'll pray, you know, we have our breviary that we pray every day and I'll pray my breviary and I'll drink my coffee. I'm like, no, I'm going to drink my coffee and then I'm going to pray my breviary. Mm-hmm. And when I was eating, sometimes I'll read a book or put an audio on. I'm like, nope, I'm just going to eat and stare out the window.
Right.
And, you know, so I would wake up whenever my body woke me up, which is usually pretty early and it's still dark out. And I'd drink my coffee for like an hour. I just sit drinking my coffee, staring at the stars outside. And then I'd get up and I'd go to the other chair and I'd pray my breviary, which, you know, normally you can get done with in a half hour. I'm like an hour. I just sit there. Just slowly I'd ponder, I'd meditate. Then I'd get up and I'd go to the chapel. And then I take like an hour to say mass by myself. You know, I'm not giving a homily. Right, you know, right. I'm not like, I'm just so like
not a wide audience.
No, yeah, you know, I'm just slowly, slowly praying. I come back, I'd get my food ready. There's no meal times I had to worry about. So I was just whenever it's time to eat, I just slowly peel my egg. It would take like an exorbitant amount of time. Right. Something's like, and then I'd eat and I'd stare out the window and it was so freeing. Mm-hmm. It was so good. There was nothing calendared. There was no expectations. There's nowhere I had to be. There's nobody who needed me. There was no cell phone ringing. There's no emails to check. I wasn't doing two things at once. I wasn't juggling anything. It was the best retreat I've ever had.
Isn't it amazing what happens when we give ourselves the right to not multitask?
Yeah.
If you add to my crazy list, people would say the other crazy thing you do is you enjoy backpacking. And over the years, my brothers and I and some friends, we've done some great trips in the national parks. Or mm-hmm. in the areas. And one of the things I love about the most is that you just kind of run on your time and God's time. That's really the only time you're running on, right?
Yeah.
So I get up in the morning I gotta, you know, I get things ready to go. You know, the sun's coming up. We wake up whenever, get things packed up. We're gonna go on our next segment. The rhythms, in some ways, as I was listening to you, I was thinking, you're just kind of allowing the rhythms of your life and your day to be as they would be. And you're not feeling pressed by other demands that say that that rhythm isn't worth anything, right? Like you're just kind of allowing that to kind of play out. And I think with backpacking and that element, it's just the same way. It's just the rhythm of walking, right? The simple act of walking, which really isn't at all from a neurological standpoint simple, right? And something that we take for granted like everything else. But allowing that, even the flow up and down the hills, all of that, it really just provides an amazing opportunity for greater reflection, introspection, greater appreciation, gratitude, all of that, right? The thing that we really desire in our lives, but I would say, and I certainly am guilty many times of being busy and just saying, well, I desire it, but like, I really can't afford to give it up for other things I need to do, right?
And so I ended up not reading any of the book. Mm-hmm. I didn't do any of the project. And I wasn't bored. Seven days in a cabin by myself. I wasn't bored for a second.
Yeah.
And same thing, you know, I've been up in Boundary Waters and same thing, like me and my buddies, we wake up, we drink our coffee, we talk staring at the lake. And then we're like, well, we missed the morning fishing. We should probably stop drinking coffee so we can have our hour fast before we say mad.
Right. You know? At some point we probably,
So why, I mean, from, you know, from your clinical experience, like why, when we've experienced this, and I think probably most listeners can say, I've had a time where, you know, my phone broke and I was without it or I lost it. And like, though, even though there's some inconveniences, my phone broke a month ago or so. And like, I had to print out directions. I had to print out, but other than that, like, we probably have those moments where like, it's actually good. Mm-hmm. Why do we find it so hard to do the things that we know we should do? Hearing St. Paul here.
I think the big thing is that the demands are around us. We have been conditioned to see them as more important than, let's say, carving out silence, right? So we have, from an early age, been conditioned to say that being progressive, being productive is getting more things done, right? So that's what we've been told. And so, you know, we kind of adhere to that. And it's understandable, again, because our lives are busy, that we feel almost guilty if we don't utilize our time in ways that are most productive.
Yeah.
So I would say that part of it is really, part of it is an artifact of the lives that we lead in this kind of, if we're very honest, we have very privileged lives that we're able to do all the things that we can do, you know, but with privilege then comes pressure. And the question is, you know, are we kind of bound by that? And so part of it's the social conditioning of that. Mm-hmm. And I also think that part of it is, and it was interesting years ago, we're part of it's called the Godcast, but podcast group that's locally. And typically there's a podcast that, you know, is listened to, and then, you know, you come together for discussion. And my wife and I decided one day that we were going to, instead of having a podcast, we were going to do, it's 20 minutes of silence, right? Mm. And that was the podcast for each person. All you had to do was go for 20 minutes of silence and then kind of reflect on what that was like. And I think that the other piece is that we oftentimes can be kind of fearful. Like, I think when people are hearing you describe that, there's a group listening that says, I don't know, Father, like, mm-hmm. that kind of, I'm afraid of what I might start hearing myself, or I'm afraid of what boredom might do.
Yeah.
And so we have been kind of made afraid of a sense of silence that our predecessors really didn't have a choice, right? Because back when you were 100 years ago working on the farm, you didn't have, you know, your earbuds in. There was nothing to basically not create the silence for you. That today we can kind of find our ways to create enough noise that we don't really have to reflect that. So I would argue that part of it's conditioning and part of it's fear that kind of keeps us away from seeing that as something that is necessary for our lives. And not just
I think about that, you know, like you think about St. John Vianney, you know, patron saint of priests, and, you know, he's 16 hours in the confessional and, you know, all this great ministry. And I'm like, yeah, but he didn't have a cell phone. He didn't have to respond to text messages and emails and just this radical accessibility.
Yeah.
And you think, like, well, what about, I mean, people are dying, you know, like, what if, like, yeah, well, they were dying back then too. And if somebody was dying, you went and got the priest, you know, sent somebody to walk and run to get the priest, and right. he ran with you back. And
right.
It's just different level. And I know, I mean, like, I don't know if how much you know, probably in your practice, but you've probably heard, I mean, like, there's a mental health crisis among children. There's also a mental health crisis among priests.
And adults in general too.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes.
And I know
yes.
priests who, like, good men who take their holy hour every day and are faithful to their prayers and mm-hmm. and suffer from anxiety and mm-hmm. depression and mm-hmm. Because there are so many demands. And so, you know, like, I mean, some people are always mad at, you know, for all the ages of the church, you know, people have been mad at the priests for whatever, mm-hmm. but now they can, when they're in their frustration or anger, they can shoot them off an angry text message or email. Whereas before, like, ah, I'm so mad at the priest, and okay, by the time I see him, I'm not that mad anymore. Right. It's not that big of a deal because those things weigh. It's so heavy. And I think, I mean, that's what we see with, you know, the social media amongst children, especially. It's like somebody says something because they can just say it, and now it's just weighing on them, and they don't have the tools to.
That's right. Well, and it not only is it weighing on them, it also never really goes away from an online perspective too. You know, think about this, like when I was in high school and none of us had cell phones and I graduated in 1995, you know, the internet was not being used. If something happened at school that, you know, was embarrassing or whatever, I mean, obviously you encounter it and it was uncomfortable, you know, that kind of went on. And maybe that came back to school the next day and for a little while.
Yeah, a week later, it's gone.
Well, it's gone. Yeah. Today, something happens. There's a good chance it was recorded.
Yeah.
It's posted. It continues to grow a life on social media. And so these kids, and I think this is something that's really, really important for people to know, is that when you look at the young teenagers, that is our brain development is most prime for social feedback. And in some ways it's how we're designed, because as you're getting older, the social world becomes increasingly important at 6th to 8th grade, right? And that's when you start to establish relationships and even romantic relationships and things like that.
Yeah.
The problem with the onset of social media being, especially when it is that overlays that most sensitive period. So whereas you and I, even if we say, oh, it can weigh on us, you know, our ages, it weighs significantly on those younger teens because they are primed in that way.
Yeah.
So then it just, you know, it becomes a real burden. And, you know, it's interesting. The friend I mentioned earlier, he reviews scholarships for, it's, you know, one of the scholarship applications, kind of the highest level scholarship in Indiana. So he's one of those reviewers. And one of the questions was asked this year, of all the things that have happened in the world, all the things that have occurred, which one would you most wish had never happened? Two things emerged most out of all the answers. And interestingly, it was vaping and smoking and cell phones. Those were the number ones that the seniors who were answering this question most said, despite all the conveniences, I just wish I didn't have to deal with it. I wish that I hadn't. And I think that it's the sense of pressure, you know, it's like, whoo, that's, I joke that back in high school, I was already really busy. Yeah. At least I thought I was busy. Right. And that was, you know, with everything going on in athletics and academics, but overlay that with all that these teens have to manage what's coming into their phone, and that level added pressure, even if it's good stuff, can be a lot. And I think that's kind of something we really have to discern in the social experiment that we've been a part of here.
Yeah. No, it is. And I think, you know, I'm like, every age has its own challenges, right. and human beings, we are adaptable. But that doesn't mean we should just keep walking into. I had this conversation with our middle schoolers last week, actually, in the school, just talking about technology and how this is the problem with the technological scientistic mind in, you know, from the early 1900s and on, or even late 1800s, we're like, wow, look what we can do. Mm-hmm. Ooh, if we can do that, we can do this. If we can do that, we can do this. We can do that. And nobody ever stopped and said, whoa, 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 should we?
Right.
Should we do that?
Yes.
And I think the first time that we had kind of a global wake-up call was Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, mm-hmm. whoa, look what we just did. Should we have asked the question, you know, back here, should we do this? Not can we do this?
Yeah.
And we can kind of get like bloodthirsty, like, wow, ooh, yeah, you know, breaking a new record and designing a new thing. And And that's that, you know, so from the moral perspective, especially for Christians, that's always a question. Should I be doing? I can do a lot of things.
Well, and I think, and I said this in one of the books I wrote, that I think, you know, we have a very outcomes focused society, but a very process oriented God, right? You think about like this pursuit of virtue. Really, everything that God asks us to do is to say, adopt my process, right? I'm laying this out for you, right? And nothing's guaranteed in life on this world. You could do everything according to the process, but things may happen that you don't want to happen. But I need you to adopt this process. I need you to pursue the virtues of love and faith and hope and, you know, temperance and charity, you know, or temperance and justice, because there's lots of reasons that that inherently is not only good for you, but also around us, right? But then our society says, back to what you just said, but look what we can do, right? And look at how we can achieve. And so again, doing and achieving in a lot of ways is not a bad thing, but I feel as if we get caught in this trap of thinking that that becomes a God in of itself, right?
Yeah.
What outcome can I get to? And I really like how you frame it, because we're often so focused on the outcome that we don't even sure about the questions that we might need to be asking, right? Like, just because I can do this, but really, should I do this? Or do I want to do this, right? Do I want to go after that, you know, like new innovation, even if it's going to compromise my own internal state? I think that's the thing that we're kind of faced with today, especially with this whole revolution, is the innovation. I can't argue it's phenomenal. Like having a supercomputer in your hand is, I can't imagine like the technology that's behind it. So I don't have any issue with the technology, and it is phenomenal and used well. I think it can be used, you know, for good purposes. But should we use it in the way we're using it is really a question we need to be asking, right? Yeah. Not can we, but should we? And do we want to? And I think that when people give me a hard time, and it is always a good topic of conversation, we're like, wait, you don't have a cell phone? Like, and when, if people are ever interested in that conversation, one of the things I just have said for me is, because I'm so busy, father of eight, and he was a pediatric psychologist and a vice president of our psychology department and training director in all these roles, I started realizing early on in my life that I think, unfortunately for me, and everybody has to make their own decision, having the cell phone was going to further distract me. It was one of the reasons why I realized, like, I think that I can take on these roles better, psychologically feel healthier without it, you know, and there are times where it's inconvenient, but most of the time I'm really glad that, again, and people around me have supported me, even though they gave me a hard time. I'm glad to have a CEO and others who recognize, like, hey, you know, I may never agree with him, but like, I can understand why he's making that decision. So
and I think that's the hard thing is we don't do well with moderation in general. Right. That's hard. That's right. a virtue. Virtues in the middle, and so it's like, I'm not going to have one at all. That might be easier than like using one moderately, you know, because we tend to over, and we know that. And we're like, right. I hear confessions, and many of those confessions have to do with an overuse of technology in some way or another, you know? Right. And sometimes it's just the scrolling, you know, like, you know, raise your hand if you've ever confessed, I just wasted time scrolling, you know, social media or watching YouTube videos or whatever. And so I think, you know, from the spiritual perspective, we want to get better at discerning the discernment of spirits. I mean, so this was Ignatius of Loyola's, you know, big contribution to the church. Not that he invented it, but he kind of mainstreamed it, that he was stuck in his hospital bed and he's reading these stories of knights and fair ladies and all this. And he loves that stuff. And he's a military guy and he's a hero and he's a manly dude. And he's reading these stories and he's like, yeah, this is great. And he closed the book and he said it. And then he just start to feel himself like empty. And then somebody gave him some stories of the life of Christ and the life of the saints. And he would read that. And it wasn't as, you know, passionate response, but it still enlivened him in some way that when he put the book down, that stayed. And we need to have a similar discernment with our technology. Right. You know, after I've stayed up too late, scrolling Facebook and finally put the phone down and lie in bed, right then, what am I feeling right then? Am I feeling like, that was time well spent? Yes. Or you know, like when you get off of a phone call with a good friend and put your, like, and then discern that, like, oh, I feel I feel mm-hmm. good. Like I just had a meaningful connection mm-hmm. and that was good. So if I can learn how to use my phone for, well, you know what, the convenience of, hey Siri, take me to this place. Then my phone's gonna like ring somewhere. it like, okay, rather than like, oh shoot, because I'm like directionally impaired and you know, I'm gonna be lost everywhere. Okay, right. Can I use it for that and making the phone calls and the few other things that it, is it a tool or am I like constantly thinking about it and discerning that like, oh, I'm agitated right now. Is it have something to do with the technology in my pocket?
Yeah.
If it does, then how do I find a way to treat it more like a real phone that's actually was, you know, on the wall somewhere in some other room, you know?
Right.
But I think that like, does this make my life better? And then define better. What do you mean by better?
That's right.
More peaceful, more human, more loving, more joyful. If it's not doing those things, then, you know, maybe mm-hmm. it's, maybe I should mitigate it or get rid of it or downgrade it.
There's a study what looks at different types of happiness and well-being. And this is really interesting that you're into this. And they talk about defining two different kinds of what we consider well-being. One is hedonic well-being. And that's the idea of like, let's say I go to, you know, like Dairy Queen, I get a Blizzard, right? And it feels good and I love it. You know, it's at that moment, it's great. And again, God created us in a lot of ways and that there's nothing necessarily wrong with what we're talking about. But hedonic well-being is contrasted where I feel good.
Just the hedonism. Mm-hmm. That's where we're talking about hedonism.
Right. So it's the pleasure and the happiness that I get derived versus what we call eudaimonic, with EU is eudaimonic well-being, which is feeling good about myself. And what they find is that when you look at like sources of happiness, and they've done a lot of research around this area, you know, there's the engaged life, the meaningful life, and the pleasurable life, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. All three contribute to overall happiness and contentment. But when they look at people who sustain it the longest, it tends to be those who create more of the meaningful life and the engaged life and don't rely as much on the like hedonistic pleasurable side, right? Mm-hmm. Because what they find, and maybe this is in some ways we as Christians kind of contrast joy and happiness, is that the sense of joy in the sense of like eudaimonic well-being resonates long after the actual act itself has occurred, right? Like you and I were on the way here, we were talking about running and we were talking about this idea of sometimes you're in the middle of a run, you think, oh man, you know, like maybe not right now, like doing things much more enjoyable, pleasurable. Yeah. But most of the time after a run, we feel good about ourselves and feel good about what's gone on. And even I've had runs before, even days later, even more than that, I still feel a sense of positivity that kind of originates, right? And I think that idea of eudaimonic well-being, like, for example, the research behind volunteering is really, really neat. You know, we're in the season of Lent, right? And giving alms and helping others is a big part of Lent. Well, there's some really great research that indicates that the person who volunteers can really reap a lot of social and psychological benefits from the act of volunteering, right? And so there we have this idea of, I'm not only doing something that feels good maybe in the moment, but like I feel good about myself. And there's a concept that came in the early 80s that's called the concept, and it's pretty straightforward, but the idea of mattering. So like when I feel like I matter to mm-hmm. other people, or I matter to my world, or I matter to God, I'm much more likely to feel a sustained sense of positive mood, you know, in general. But if I don't feel like I matter, if I don't think, you know, because when I go eat that Blizzard at Dairy Queen, like it feels good, but like I'm not sure that matters a whole lot mm-hmm, to other people.
Right.
When I don't have consistent sources of eudaimonic well-being and a sense of mattering, then I find myself kind of vacillating over and over in ways that it feels transient, right?
Yeah.
And it just feels like, ugh, I'm a little bit lost there.
Well, and I think that gets to, you know, like the convenience. We're like, oh, we're, if we get more convenient and more convenient.
Right.
But nobody ever felt good about themselves in a eudaimonic way after doing something that was just merely easy and convenient.
Right.
You know, and I think this is, you know, like the running, like nobody brags about having done something easy. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody says like, you know what, you know, the Blizzard I ate yesterday. It's like, no, you brag.
I had four of them. Okay.
You know, like you brag about something that was really hard. Like, mm-hmm. hey, I ran 50 miles yesterday. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa. Yeah. Like, yeah, I remember I was listening to a book, and there's somebody's talking about like why we run. Why do we people ask, why do we run? We don't run because it's fun.
No,
we run because it's hard. And that's
because
like
it's meaningful.
Yeah,
and because inherent in that, like we were talking about before, there's an invitation to reflect more deeply, to kind of grow, right?
Yeah.
But not because you think, oh, it's, you know, 20 degrees outside and I really want to pound out 10 miles today. Yeah. There. Right.
But isn't that fascinating that what we don't want to do is the thing that if we do it, we're going to brag about it.
Yeah.
The thing that we struggle the most to get out the door for, whether it's to run 50 miles or to go and volunteer somewhere, because it's like, oh, you know, the homeless people smell and they're weird. And then you go and then you're like, wow, that was so good. It stays with you. Mm-hmm. It's the type of thing that you like tell people about, like, yeah, we went downtown and like gave sandwiches to homeless people on the streets. It was mm-hmm. hard. It was scary.
But it was meaningful.
I did that. It meant something.
It meant something. And I think that's the point of connection. One of the things I've over the years decided to do is that whenever I, like I said, I bike to work and, you know, certainly run and do a lot of things, I feel a real sense of connection to people, especially when they're going through difficult times. And so I tend to offer every run that I do to someone that's going through something.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's years ago, I had just come off. My friend accidentally shut my finger in the door a day before a half marathon.
Oh, no.
And broke it. I later had to have surgery. And so the next morning I'm out, you know, getting ready to run. And, you know, I'm just kind of like, there's a little minor, but there's pain there. But the more I connected myself with people who were struggling more than I was, there was a deep, deep sense of meaning and purpose to that.
Mm.
And I think that's the offering here that comes with this idea of doing things that are hard, but they have great meaning, is that we start to sense that this world is not just about us, of course, right? You know, Thomas Merton said, we don't live for ourselves. And he's right, you know. And of course, Mother Teresa years ago said, you know, you may do all the things in the world you think God's calling you to do, and people may tear it down, but it wasn't about them anyway. Ultimately, it's a spiritual pursuit. But all of that, we're taking on difficult things because, not because it's just intrinsically fun often, but because it means something. And I think the deeper you get there, and from a psychologist standpoint, you find that you build this source of like this well grows.
Yeah.
And there's been things decades later I can come back to that let's say it's been a difficult day, right? Or, you know, that things are not going the way, or you feel like you're criticized on many levels. But there are things I can come back to where I felt like that I really spending that time with God. And I do say that to people these days. They often ask, you know, what are you training for? What are you doing? And truth be told, it's wonderful prayer time. It's wonderful mm-hmm. time to spend with God. And yes, I may be training for something or whatever, and that allows me to channel it specifically into a discipline. But really, I really mostly am creating avenues of silence, like we were talking mm-hmm. about earlier, mm-hmm. prioritizing it, and then being able to be in a place where it doesn't matter what my role, status, et cetera, is. Like, I'm most a child of God. That's the most important.
Oh, amen.
Right?
Amen. Yeah.
And that's so important for me in my life to be able to have those regular sources.
Yeah. But and how beautiful too that, you know, like this is how God designed us.
You
know,
we're designed.
We're designed to do hard, meaningful things. And yet our fallen human nature shirks against that. And yet when we do those things, you know, this is that resistance, like mm-hmm. I'm resisting the good thing because it's hard, even though I know I've had those experiences where I actually feel better afterwards for longer. And I think maybe to kind of draw the conversation to a conclusion and come back, like how can cell phones, technology, whatever aside, how can we help our children to grow in the love of hard, meaningful things?
Yeah, I think we early on have to really engender a couple things on this thought. I think that it's important for our kids at the youngest of ages to recognize that all life is an adventure, right?
Yeah.
It is an adventure. Okay. And we may not like this adventure.
Yeah.
We may not like the way that things are going. I often, you know, kind of say that
adventure is conflict,
it's
and conflict is hard.
It is hard. But here's the thing. If you, everyone loves a good adventure story when you're reading it, you just may not love it when it's your life. Right. But what someone who really embraces adventure embraces the idea that even those times when you're down, or even when things are difficult, they are replete, they're full of meaning. And I think that one of the things we need to do with our kids is to really, like, really engender them in this idea that life is an adventure, and it's going to be tough. And you're going to think, you know, the thing about happiness is the only thing happiness teaches us typically is that we want more of it, right? When you're feeling great, you really just kind of want more of it. But it's only the times when things get more difficult, right? The only the times when you kind of encounter obstacles that you're faced with this question of, well, can you grow or should you grow, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, as we kind of draw this to a close, one of the things is to really kind of excite our children, because I worry that our kids stay in this culture of convenience, see that things that are difficult are unnecessary. And it's not that we should, just go forward and say, oh, again, suffering in itself is not in a virtue, right? We shouldn't just necessarily do things just because it's hard without any greater purpose. But, like, we do want to say, hey, don't be afraid of things being difficult and find excitement in it. And then I will say this, one of the great joys of my last 5 years is that through my running, my own kids, they've done some half marathons and I've been able to train with them.
Yeah.
And the early morning hours, you know, just yesterday, my son and I got up and it was, you know, it was like 35 degrees and the wind was blowing. It's probably 15 or 20 miles an hour. And, you know, we ran just a 5K, whatever, it was short. But that time spent alone with Noah is some of the greatest joy I feel, period.
Yeah.
We're doing things together that we don't have to do. We're sharing it. We're sharing the difficulty. We're sharing the purpose. And then we go about our days. And, you know, we come back to that same place. And so it's been definitely a great joy.
Amen. Beautiful. Well, yeah, this has been great.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the invitation. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's always a lot of fun to share kind of that way.
Yeah. Awesome. And I think, yeah, it's the intentionality, the attunedness to what's going on inside and not letting the rules of, you know, pop culture raise our children or dictate what we do or whatever else. Like, what's the Lord calling us to?
For sure. So. Yeah.
Good. Well, I think that's a wrap.
That's great. Yeah. Thanks so much, Father, for inviting me again. So.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next time.
Thank you.